We have to wait like 6 seconds, right?
Just about, sir.
Okay. The Senate Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness will come to order. Colleagues, welcome to the new session. Just very quickly, I'm going to run through what we're planning on doing because we have some testimony that's online, some representatives that need to testify. First, we're very quickly going to adopt committee rules under adoption of committee rules, and then we're going to drop down to SB 408 so Representative Kennemer can make his testimony and move on to another event, close that out temporarily, and then go back to 157, which is on our schedule. So therefore, at this point, I'm going to open a work session for the adoption of committee rules. Colleagues, it is the Model Senate Committee Rules. I believe everybody's already been in a committee someplace else, so we're familiar with these. I haven't heard any pushback from anybody, and even I voted for these in my other committees. Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Boak, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated today, February 3rd, 2015.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves to adopt the committee rules dated today. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, we now have rules of for organization. I'm going to close that work session. And Madam Vice Chair, beginning of the meeting.
Now okay.
We're formally organized.
Thank you, Chair. I always love to read some of the Voices of the Guard. This is the Oregon National Guard. It comes from Voices of the Guard, compiled by Francis Ritchie. And this one is titled Home, and written by one of our Oregon veterans. My biggest want was to come home. The door opened on the back of the C-130. The air came in. You could smell a little of the jet fuel, but it was just that crystal clear air here in Oregon. Absolutely crystal clear. And you could see trees in the background, green. And it was like your eyes were starving for green. It is so clean out here. A few seconds of this is so wonderful. And then it was, man, I'm supposed to be the last one. It's supposed to be my Joes getting off the plane first, not me. They put us on little buses, all of us on gurneys, took us to the hospital. My wife met me up there. She wasn't sure when we were going to land. I didn't know either, so she made her way up there. She had my little boy walk in the room first. He was two. And she said, hey, who's that? And he goes, that's Daddy. And I go, come here, little guy, and held on to him. But I didn't really feel home because, you know, I still had my whole platoon overseas. You really can't rest, and you shouldn't, until you know they're okay. When they came home, I came home with them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And colleagues, members of the public, so I'll remind you, we're hoping that by late June, maybe this year, we should have most of our National Guard soldiers back from across the pond if all things go well. With that, we're going to drop down and open a public hearing on SB 408. Madam Counsel, if you would please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 408 has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It appropriates general fund dollars to the Oregon Military Department for purposes of Oregon Military Museum. It declares an emergency is effective on passage.
Thank you, Council. And just for the record, so everybody knows what's going on, we are actually down at 408. The good representative has other commitments. He's going to testify, and then we're going to close that public hearing temporarily and go back to the normal agenda. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Kennemer, State Representative, District 39. Thank you so much for letting me come first, and I want to thank Senator Lori Moniz Anderson for letting me co-sponsor with her this special bill. I represent within a country mile this museum, and I'm very excited about it. And I thought I'd tell a little story about it because there's some people here that are going to add some incredible details about it that I don't think I need to repeat. But one of my first experiences in 1987 as a brand new state senator was I got a phone call from some enthusiastic volunteers. And they said, you got to come out to Camp Withicum and see our museum. And sure enough, I went out there, and they took me around way out into the northeast corner to this kind of nondescript little, I guess it'd be okay if I said the slightly dumpy kind of building, and they opened it up and they took me in and began to show me some treasures that they had. And after a little bit of discussion, they decided they would unlock the back door. And they unlocked the back door, and they cautioned me not to stand up erect because you'd bump your head on the ceiling. And they showed me their collection of rifles, some incredible antique rifles and all kinds of stuff. And they were so excited about this. And what a treasure we had. And for years, they staffed it with volunteers. There were lots of different issues, and about 6 years ago, that closed. But we have all of this stuff, and the collection has kept growing. And now you're going to learn in a few minutes about $64 million worth of collection at this point. 30,000 volumes that for a library. And a fabulous facility. I've seen some of the preliminary stuff. It's great. I think you're going to be excited about it. I'm excited about it. I urge your support of it. I think it'll be a tremendous addition to our community, a great response to our veterans, and an opportunity for the veterans that are coming back from the war and the youngsters that are growing up to understand our history, to understand the military, and to understand the importance of Camp Withicum and our local history. So I urge your support for Senate Bill 408, and I thank you for the time to speak, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Representative. Madam Vice Chair, any questions? Mr. President, any questions?
No.
Mr. Olster, any questions?
No.
Thank you very much. We'll take this issue up again in about 30 minutes.
Fantastic.
And we'll go on from there.
And thank you again for letting me speak early.
You're welcome. We're going to close the public hearing on SB 408 till a later time today, and then we're going to open a public hearing on SB 157. The reason we're doing this again is we have some individuals that have to go into court in a few minutes. And so, Council, if you'll review SB 157, and then Madam Vice Chair, if you want to make any comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 157 has no subsequent referral. It requires the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to generate a report on veterans courts to the interim legislative veterans committees by July 1, 2016. It specifies the contents of that report, and it declares an emergency is effective on passage.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleague Senator Boquist and I discussed this issue, and this was really a placeholder bill, because we've dealt with veterans courts in the past. We don't really know what we need, what the various counties should need. I know we have the reports, but then some counties don't do anything. Multnomah County has just done something, and we'll be hearing from them. But there is really a growing effort nationally and in Oregon to institute veterans courts or specialty courts or dockets to allow district attorneys to send military members and veterans into treatment rather than jail when they commit a nonviolent offense. And so I have testimony. It's on record. I won't read it for those of you who want to look at that. But it explains about veterans courts and veteran treatment courts. And what we want to know is just what is there out there. And we need from you, what do you need, if anything, from us to make sure that we are handling our veterans in the most appropriate manner, especially once they come back from the war zones. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Just so everybody's clear here, as the good Vice Chair said, what we're trying to do is figure out if and what we need to do next. And in the legislative process, if you don't know, those of you that are out there not in the room or not familiar with the process, is we have to have a bill and some sort of mechanism. So the definition of a placeholder is exactly that. It's sitting here where, you know, we may be doing everything we can do already, and we might not be everything we're doing that we should be doing, and that's the purpose of going through this process with here. I believe Mr. Tillman from Klamath Falls is actually on the line, which is why we're kind of rushing along. He's supposed to be in court in 15 minutes. And so are you there, Mr. Tillman?
Yes, sir.
You're before the committee and about, I guess, 25 people in the room and who knows on the internet.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chair Boquist, and good afternoon to you and members of the committee.
Please introduce yourself.
Yes, I'm Steve Tilson. I'm the treatment court coordinator for Klamath County Circuit Court.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, thank you. I have no prepared testimony this afternoon. I was contacted just yesterday. I do understand that the committee would like to learn what distinguishes a veterans treatment court from other treatment courts, perhaps drug courts. Would that be correct?
That's correct.
Well, I can address that. The Klamath County Veterans Treatment Court was built to follow the national model of a treatment court, the 10 key components that define primarily drug courts. So a veterans treatment court is an adaptation of a drug court, and the two things that distinguish it from a drug court are, one is that the United States Veterans Health Administration is the primary treatment provider.
Who is this?
So we have federal dollars coming in, funding and delivering health care benefits that our veteran participants have earned through their military service. And the other feature that distinguishes a veterans treatment court from a drug court would be our application of volunteer veteran peer mentors. They serve as sponsors and support for our veteran participants. And it's essentially matching up our veteran defendants with another veteran who is doing well in life that can say, hey, I've been there and done that too. I know where you've been. And those two things combine, along with the exclusively veteran docket, to create a culture that understands the veteran experience and, we believe, contributes to program success and better outcomes.
Madam Vice Chair?
How many have you dealt with over the last year or couple of years? What are we dealing with here? Is it a real huge problem, or?
Well, we built a program in November of 2010 and thought perhaps we'd be seeing a dozen or maybe 15 veterans on our docket at any given time. We quickly built up to 25 current participants. That's how many we have today, and we've been running around two dozen in our over 4 years of operation. We graduated 34 of them, terminated four of them. One passed away while in the program due to an auto accident. So we've admitted 68 total in our 4 years of operation, three of them female.
Follow up, Madam Vice Chair.
And what is the length of time for treatment?
The average, most treatment is completed within a year, and we're talking mental health treatment for issues such as PTSD and traumatic brain injury, and also treatment for substance abuse. Most of that is done within a year's time, but we keep monitoring our veterans after treatment is done, getting them hooked up with other supports and systems to just help improve their lives. And the average length of stay for all our participants in the program has been about 16 and a half months.
Wow.
Thank you. And Mr. Locke, if you hadn't set the docket up or set the court up the way you have, you know, has there been a cost savings? Has there been better outcomes? Where would they have gone before? Or what would have happened before?
Yes, what would have happened would have been these veterans would have just been processed in the traditional way through the criminal justice system with little attention to really effective delivery of behavioral health care services and physical health care services. And we believe that problems in the area of behavioral health and physical health have contributed to the veterans' involvement in the justice system. So by focusing our attention on those health care problems and helping the veteran become well, we believe we are reducing the likelihood of further penetration into the justice system. Of the 68 that we've admitted, we are aware of four recidivists, four who have reoffended after graduation. And in comparison to our other treatment courts, that number is low.
Just as a follow-up, I mean, the number's not just low. It's pretty astounding. I mean, in some of our other areas, we're up around 75%. 75% of 68 puts us well over 50. I mean, that's a pretty remarkable number. Has it cost more in immediate up front? Because what we're talking is long-term benefits, both in health, physical, and cost. I mean, has it... Because one of the pushbacks we get, and we've been concerned, the vice chair and I have, is we get a pushback of, well, it costs too much money to set up a separate court, so on and so forth like that. What was your experience in that? What I mean, is that true or false?
That would be true. It is. There are additional costs. We have no separate dedicated budget, but we have to carve out time in the courts and my time for coordination. Our justice system partners, defense and prosecution, have to carve out additional time. Our VA partners and other community partners have to carve out additional time. So it's all in kind. And so while it means we don't need a grant or a budget to operate, there certainly is an investment. But what that investment produces is really incredible. If you observe the progress of a veteran defendant through the program, they can come in looking pretty rugged, pretty hard drinking, hard drugging, just hard life. And as the weeks and months go by, you see them become better and healthier and just happier and looking well. So it really is heartening as a transformative human experience.
My vice chair, President, questions?
Here's a question.
Yeah. Senator Courtney.
So I don't know who's in the audience. This is Senator Courtney, Mr. Tillman, so I don't know whether I should wait or not. I don't quite help me with how this works. So an individual, veteran, I guess, gets in trouble with the law. Can I say that, right? Is that right?
Correct.
All right, they go out there, there's an assault and battery, they're brought in. What, they're brought in before the court for arraignment, and or do they plead guilty, and after they plead, the sentence involves such. I mean, I don't quite... I hear the words, and everybody else in the room probably understands this, but here we are. Let's just take veteran 007. He's back from many tours of duty. He's out there in Klamath County one night. He gets in a fight with a police officer who stops him for a broken taillight or something, and he's brought into the court the next morning, the next Monday, whatever. Tell me how 007. Just tell me how this all happens. I don't know how to visualize it.
Okay, I'll try to describe it as briefly as possible. We have multiple intercept points. The first would be if veteran 007 gets lodged in jail. Jail booking will ask if he has ever served in the U.S. military. If the answer is yes, are you interested in Veterans Treatment Court? Here's an application to fill out, which will have the VA treatment providers get a hold of you. Then veteran 007 will talk to his attorney about, hey, can I get this case into Veterans Treatment Court? Sometimes the defense attorney will propose that suggestion to their client. Similarly, the prosecution attorneys, the district attorney's office may say, hey, we've got a good candidate here. Each case is negotiated individually, as most of the criminal cases in around the state are. We have no fixed adjudicatory model, but some type of mitigation is built into the sentence negotiation to reward the veteran for successful completion of the program. If they fail or bomb out, they will know also, in the alternative, here's the sentence that they might expect. Then there's a motion to, VA partners, healthcare partners, will do screenings for substance abuse and mental health problems because we must have a condition to treat. We are a treatment court. And we make a presumptive link that says, hey, these healthcare behavioral health problems are factors that contributed to the veteran's involvement in our program. Once in the program, it's operates very much like a drug court. You have judicial monitoring of the veteran's participation in clinically prescribed health and behavioral health care services. And we kind of coerce the veteran into participating in those services. And we find improved outcomes as opposed to either making no referrals or perhaps probation, who they do a great job. But aren't able to be as effective as when the veteran reports weekly or every other week to the judge and to account for their compliance or not with these treatment programs.
Thank you. That helps. Thank you.
Senator Olson? Madam Vice Chair.
I really believe in local control, but how did your county come to the decision to do this? I see many counties aren't doing anything, and to me, it seems like there is a real need. And so what was the impetus that made you come forward? And that's one question. The other is, do you see a need elsewhere also? I mean, advocate for what you're doing and how maybe we can help other counties.
Thank you. The impetus to build this program and launch it really began with the vision of one man, and that's former Klamath County District Attorney Ed Caleb, who we learned just passed away this last weekend after retiring a couple of years ago. And the story goes, he saw a documentary on PBS about veterans treatment courts. I mean, the first one started back in 2008 in Buffalo, New York, and said, you know, this would be helpful here. So he contacts our county veterans service officer, who is a person with her eyes and ears and, you know, a finger on the pulse of the veteran community. And they gathered together a planning group that consists of justice system folks, prosecution, defense, courts, and veteran service organizations. Our VA healthcare partners are there, and we start discussing what are the problems and what are the resources available to address those problems. So by creating kind of a collaborative, consensual group that says, yeah, this is a good idea and we can do this, it then became a matter of nuts and bolts of actually building the program and putting it in place. And that was relatively easy because we decided to follow the national model. So the hard part was just gathering up the troops and getting that common vision. That was the impetus, and I apologize. The second part of your question, please.
Just incentives to what we should do to, you know, maybe help that other counties might need to get something like this started.
Yes, thank you. Well, Klamath County, as you know, we're a fairly rural county, only 68,000 total population. We've got close to 10,000 veterans. We're told it's among the higher percentage of veterans in the county. But if you look around, they're pretty evenly distributed. For instance, I was talking to Deschutes County, almost three times our population and just about almost three times the number of vets. Assuming the same types of conditions, and if the county assumes to work a similar model, I don't know why another county couldn't be as successful.
You have a follow-up question? This is Senator Boquist. Before I go to Senator, just a question. The key hallmark here appears to me to be that instead of traditional go to court, get sentenced, go to the county jail, go to the state pen, and then see what mental health and physical services are there, what we're doing is switching it around and saying, okay, if we can treat and there's a mechanism to treat up front, you go into the treatment program right up front. So therefore, I think that has a lot to do with the recidivism rate. Am I hitting this kind of hammer or nail on the head here?
You have hit the nail on the head. It's the integration of justice system processing and treatment.
Right, up front.
And incarceration is so expensive. So even though you are spending more money in the court realm, incarceration is costing the system a whole lot more money.
And yes, that is correct, and it really is kind of the horn that all drug courts and treatment courts toot, that, you know, hey, we're more effective, we'll keep folks out of jail. Jail doesn't really do anything but arrest a problem behavior. It's not therapeutic. And instead, by investing in less expensive treatment, we are preventing the costs of additional arrests and the costs of incarceration.
One last question, Senator Olson. I know you've got to go here shortly, Steve.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, sir. You mentioned that in your treatment court, you must have a treatment. What happens if the 007 appears not to have any culpable problem? Does he go right back into the court system?
Yes, we don't admit that. That has happened on one occasion. Careful clinical screening said, hey, this person does not have a mental health problem. We can identify this person does not have a substance use disorder, and it appears that the driver for the criminal behavior is really criminal thinking. As you know, practitioners in that field will know, it's just the errors that allow a person to do things that a responsible and law-abiding person won't do. And so, with nothing to treat, we did not admit that veteran.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Thilson. I know you've got to go on to another event in the court system down there. We appreciate your testimony today as we kind of move forward with this. And I would like to say, if we have other questions, can we get back with you?
Yes, please do.
Okay.
Please do. So, Chair Boquist and members of the committee, I am privileged and honored to have testified before you today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you again. Colleagues, as is typical in fast-moving sessions, we have one of our other colleagues coming up to discuss, go back to SB 408, so we're temporarily going to close SB 157. I'll remind you that SB 408 is, in fact, on the museum. One of our colleagues has got another event, is going to testify briefly. I'm going to open a public hearing on SB 408.
Senator Chairman, Senator Boquist, members of the committee, thank you very much. I am here to testify on support of Senate Bill 408 and appreciate Chief Sponsor, Senator Mona Sanderson, to bring this forward. I believe that we need to preserve our history every opportunity we have. We have a rich history. Starting in the frontier days, south of Pilot Rock in my home county, we have a state park called Battle Mountain. It was near the site of, I believe, if not the last, almost the last Native American European descendant war that or a battle that was fought in Oregon, and all the way to the most recent engagements that Oregonians participated in. We have a rich history. It needs to be preserved. This is an opportunity to do it, and I fully support it. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Senator. And I've actually walked that battlefield, by the way.
Yeah.
I didn't even know it was there. I'm driving past, and it's okay. We're in the middle of nowhere, and there's a park here, right? Of course, it's Eastern Oregon. You're always in the middle of nowhere out there, right?
No, wait a minute.
Madam Vice Chair, questions? Mr. President? Again, we appreciate your testimony, and we're, as you can see, as typical veterans in emergency services, we're multitasking here. We're moving from place to place quickly. So thank you again,
for
sir.
Your kindness.
We'll close the public hearing temporarily on SB 407 and go back to SB 157, which is our in-depth look at veterans treatment courts and what we're doing right, what we're doing potentially better. I'm going to ask that Chuck Sparks, and I hate to say that the ink is not hard on here,
Ginger
Martin, to come up, if you would, please. And Ginger, I apologize, because I guess we're using some sort of old-fashioned pads here, where you're supposed to get through three copies, and I can't quite read it here. Plus, I can't quite see anyone. Okay. Welcome. I guess ladies first.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. I am Ginger Martin. I'm Deputy Director for the Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, which is the probation and parole agency in Multnomah County. I'm here to provide information about Multnomah County's veterans docket. In 2012, the local public safety coordinating council created a work group chaired by Commissioner Shipwreck and including all of the different entities of the local criminal justice system and also the Veterans Administration, who's been a really wonderful partner with us through developing our veterans docket. The work group was meant to look at veterans who come in contact with the criminal justice system and how we might improve access to care and also improve outcomes. We wanted to create a more coordinated approach to identifying military veterans across the system at all the points where people come into contact with different agencies. We wanted to recognize and address the unique needs of veterans. We wanted to more systematically refer them to specialized services that are already in the community and for which they are already eligible. So we are, of course, hopeful that by addressing stability factors and risk factors that we will reduce future criminal behavior. But we also recognize in our work here that we have an obligation as a community towards those who have served. As a result of all of the planning that we've done, I will say that each of our local criminal justice system partners has become much better at identifying people who come in contact with us at any point who have served in the military. And as you know, we've also created our veterans docket, so it's a little bit different take on the, it's not a treatment court, it's a kind of something I think we probably made up locally to address some of our resource considerations. We developed a memorandum of understanding that details each of the parties' responsibilities and how the docket should work. Chief Deputy Sparks is here with me today, and he's going to go through in a little bit more detail how this particular docket works.
Chair Boquist and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Chuck Sparks. I'm Chief Deputy with Multnomah County DA's office. And we collectively at Multnomah County and the criminal justice system got together about a year and a half ago and began meeting to talk about this important topic. I think the sort of the impetus came from Commissioner Shiprack and Commissioner McKeel and the local public safety coordinating committee. The effort, of course, was to get veterans connected to their benefits and also to avoid having them participate in a system that was at times not funded, so that their treatment needs would definitely be met with a robust package of services that they were entitled to. And to start that, you first need to get veterans who are coming into the criminal justice system to trust the system enough to reveal themselves as veterans and to decide that they actually do want to engage the Veterans Administration. Not all veterans want to be in that cohort. So there are several touch points in the system where veterans are coming in. Mr. Tillman from Klamath County talked about those. They're similar in Multnomah County. When a veteran talks to the release officer, to jail personnel, to his or her defense attorney, they at several points can identify as veterans, and then the participants in the system, recog officer, defense attorney, can then notify or talk to the veteran about the benefits potentially of participating. If the veteran wants to explore it further, it's not all in at that point. The veteran can say, I'm going to sign a release of information to give the VA the authority to release all of my service records, my employment history, my medical history, my mental health history, and my drug and alcohol treatment history. The veteran's attorney then sends that on to our contact person, who we have a designated Veterans Administration liaison, and that person facilitates the expedited provision of the records. Defense counsel then has those records, looks them over with his or her client, and they then make a decision about whether they want to pursue this or not, because the veteran's not required to participate in this. It's not a treatment court. It's not a court that it's a docket. The veteran can participate in this as a veteran and get the benefits of this package of services available to the veteran. So if the veteran says, yes, I'm interested in looking at this further, then the defense attorney puts together what's called a mitigation packet, which is just what it sounds like. It's a snapshot of who the veteran is and a complete unfiltered set of all the records. The veteran, on the other hand, can say, you know what, I'm not interested in participating and I just want to be treated like any other defendant. And in that sense, the defense attorney can go outside of the VA information and get, say, an independent psychological examination. It's not as though the veteran doesn't have that option. It's just that it will not be through the information available in the hands of the VA already. So the veteran has the option of being treated just like anybody else, or the veteran has the option of saying, let's get that information from the VA. Once the information has been filtered by the defense attorney, at least evaluated, then the complete set of information goes to the prosecution. We then take a look, and the certain services that are available, and it may not be evident to, to the person on the street, but when someone's ordered into probation and ordered to do drug treatment, somebody still has to fund that. And if that person doesn't have insurance, that makes that probation less likely to succeed because there is a lowered probability that that individual is actually going to get the treatment he or she needs. And it might be mental health treatment in a dual diagnosis program, or it could be other things as well, medical issues. So with the veterans package of services that are available, the state then looks at that set of resources and says, hypothetically, okay, we can take a chance. We don't need to send this person to prison on this nonviolent or lower violent level felony, because some violent felonies are actually included as well. Lower level robberies, some lower level assaults. But the state can then evaluate and say one of several things. This individual, we can take a chance on it. We can put this person on probation, and this person does not need to, on a Measure 57 case, go to prison and serve 24 months. But we can depart and go to probation. Alternatively, if you have someone with a long offending history, they might have a package that would convince you to come down on the prison sentence, so that less prison time. They still need to go to prison, but it will be a shorter sentence, because you know that when they are out on post-prison supervision, they have a more robust treatment package available for them at that time. Principally, it's expected that the cases that are prison cases, but lower end prison cases, would be diverted to probation. That is the model, if you will, that we are looking at. So when the attorney hands that information over to the state then takes it into account when making its pretrial offer and engaging in negotiations. Alternatively, the veteran can go through all of his or her due process rights, have a trial with a jury finding, and if they're convicted, the veteran can say, I'm a veteran and I want to sign the release of information now. I want to have all that information brought forth now, and I want to inform the court, the sentencing judge, what my issues are and the service package that I have available, so that when the judge makes his or her sentencing decision, they can decide, we're going to send you to prison, we're going to depart out of prison and put you on probation with this package of services. And another way for a veteran to come into the system is a veteran can be on a dispositional sentence, so a sentence that was a prison sentence that went to probation. The veteran has not previously self-identified as a veteran, but then the veteran commits a new qualifying offense, so the veteran has that probation hanging out over his or her head. Logically, they might go to prison if they violate. At that point, we might stop and take a look at the services, and even then, say potentially, we're going to divert into a probation package or a continuation of probation. And you have a newspaper article in your materials that discusses a case that came in sort of a not the way we anticipated when we set up the docket, but this is an individual who has more than 20 property offenses. I prosecuted him for robbery back in 2010. He ended up going to prison on that. He came out, he reoffended. He was given a probation sentence, which wasn't the presumptive, so the judge took a chance. He didn't do his treatment. He committed a low-level shoplift, about $40 worth of food and a sweatshirt. At that point, he said, you know what, I'm 60. I'm essentially sick and tired of being sick and tired. I know that by all rights you should send me to prison. We all said that. Yes, by all rights we should. But he self-identified as a veteran. He signed the release of information. We got the records. He was eligible for an excellent inpatient VA program. He stayed in custody till he qualified for it, and this week he went off, and we're hopeful that he'll succeed. And that avoids a 30-month prison sentence. It avoids a lot of expense to the taxpayers. And more importantly, it gets this gentleman who's 60 years old and who has served the possibility that he'll get himself back on the right track. If he doesn't, the 30 months is still out there. So that's sort of a snapshot. Senator Courtney, I know you were interested in how does this work. That's how it works.
So when did you start this?
The docket was initiated. The final MOU was June 27th of last year. It was sort of rolled out in July. It has had a slow start, I'll say, because we have, and I think in part, that we've had a lot going on in Multnomah County with HB 3194, a lot of attention, a lot of energy appropriately spent in that area. The veterans docket is, you can participate in HB 3194 options as a part of the veterans docket, so they overlap. But we now have four who are actually in the program and one who is pending, and we're hopeful that as the veterans, once we settle down a little bit in the 3194 realm and people have digested that very complicated and important set of data about how to handle their clients, that we can, a little more sunlight will shine on the veterans docket and we'll be able to get moving with some greater speed. We have two excellent judges, Judges Bergstrom and Allen, who are overseeing this docket, and the full support of Chief Judge, Presiding Judge Dan Waller, and Chief Criminal Judge Sheely Fran. So we're very happy about that.
Let's get back to the insurance. So some of these programs require insurance. Not all veterans have insurance. Is that what I'm hearing? Anyway, I would think that this might be something that counties would like to understand a little bit more. So how can we get these people onto insurance that will help support the services that they need?
You want me to take that? Senator Boquist, Senator Juana Sanderson, we in probation and parole have been working closely with the Veterans Administration to identify veterans and make sure that they are receiving the benefits that they are entitled to. So it's really more making sure that people get benefits so that they're not then relying on other county-funded services when they have a benefit that would be exactly what they need and that they're entitled to. So it's a matter of locating, finding folks, and then making sure that we understand and get them connected with what their benefits are.
Thank you.
Senator Montez Anderson, Vice Chair, may I follow up briefly on that? The and thank you, Chair Boquist. I don't want to create a misperception. People who have no insurance are still able to get services. They're county funded services. Obviously, dollars are short, always short, and the services are scarcer. And so the first thing that somebody looks to is if a defendant comes on to probation, do you have private insurance? And if that is true, that defendant then can then satisfy their probation obligations with their insurance-funded treatment and care. So it's a longer line to wait to get into the services that are available on the counties, if the county's paying for it. And here, and this is something that Commissioners Shiprock and McKeel were very adamant about, and rightly so, we've got these veterans, and they constitute a substantial percentage of our, and I don't want to, it's not like veterans are offending at a higher rate, but of our jail population, you have a percentage, an identifiable percentage, who are veterans and are entitled, if you analyze the benefits they're entitled to these resources. Why not get them connected to these resources? The gentleman who's the subject of the article is in the White City program. It's an inpatient program that would be very hard to fund, I think, at the county level. And here we have federal benefits paying for it, which is a relief to the county in that sense. We're all federal taxpayers too, but it's something that veteran has earned. And so we're actually really happy that he's decided to take us up on that and go that route.
So to put it in a capsule, impossible is probably the county's not going to fund it because there just isn't that money. But I think what we're really back at, and this, all four members of this committee have been big on this from the beginning, and it's, this legislature has been on, and that's Commissioner Shipwreck shares the same thing we do, is I think what you're saying here, and I think what Klamath Falls was saying, is there are a set of benefits out there that a veteran may be eligible for from the Veterans Administration or other sources that the average person would not be. The trick to whether you're doing a docket or whether you're doing a court, and I think yours is more simplified, and I look out and see some of the senior officers senior to me, and I saw them when you were explaining this, and they're thinking the same thing I am. Well, this guy's got three strikes already, okay? That, one of your examples. But at the front end of this, if you can take a docket or a court and say, hey, he doesn't have insurance or she doesn't have insurance and we don't have the resources, but if we use the benefits as a veteran they had and stuck those into here, we might have a success rate the first time around, which is then the recidivism rate. Because everything you were talking about here is totally different than I think I heard from Klamath Falls. I'm hearing county, county, county in Klamath Falls, and what I'm hearing you saying is state, state, state. I mean, I heard 24-month sentence, 36-month sentence. I remember from the days of judiciary, we're talking they're going to corrections. They're going to state corrections at how much per bed, you know, Vice Chair? And is that the crux there? And you guys in Klamath County and these other have been able to identify that set of resources that you can go reach out to? Is that really the key issue?
Chair Boquist, I think that is. That's what we have are cases that are in the gray area that, you know, boy, do we give this guy one more chance? He really seems to want it, or do we not? And it's a lot easier to say, yes, we do, when that person will, as is true with the gentleman in the article, stay in custody until he's released to this inpatient treatment program. And with that assurance that there will be some robust care provided to this gentleman, you can go out on a limb and more readily rely on the services that are there. And he's entitled to these services, and we want him to get them because we're all better off. If he reforms himself, to Vice Chair Moniz Anderson's point, the prison bed is a very expensive commodity. And if we can take federal dollars that he's entitled to and get him inpatient treatment, we're not going to be silly about it. We're not going to do, I mean, we hope we won't. We're not going to do this in cases where somebody really does need to go to prison. But when you have a property offender, particularly, there's a little bit more willingness to rely upon this package of services as an alternative.
Senator Wilson, you have a question?
Yes. You talk about the VA insurance that's available to them. Well, we now have a federal insurance plan that covers everybody. Are you able to, if a client comes in that's not insured, are you able to get them into that insurance program and have some of that insurance money cover it, or is that beyond the scope of that insurance?
You're talking about the Affordable Care Act, Senator Olson, Chairman Boquist. As I understand it, and Ms. Martin will be the expert here, the Affordable Care Act has really provided a substantial number of supports. There are more people who are insured. Is that?
That's correct. But I also think there's some value in getting services for vets that are specialized for veterans from people who kind of understand some of the common experiences that a veteran may have had that somebody who's not served hasn't had. So it is true that with the Affordable Care Act, insurance is not such a limitation, but I think we do have a preference for getting veterans into services that are particularly designed to respond to some of their unique experiences.
I appreciate the preference, but if a person is unable to garner those veterans' benefits, will he be able to use the Affordable Care Act benefits to help him? Otherwise, he's cast to the wind and ends up in prison.
Yeah. Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, along with this planning around the court, probation and parole has created specialized caseloads, and so if somebody gets probation or post-prison supervision, they will come to us, and we look across resources that are available. So, yes, if a person has health coverage through the Oregon Health Plan, for example, they have access to all kinds of community resources. This wouldn't be a barrier. This is more of an enhancement to what might otherwise be available, but we are not going to see people going without service simply because they are a veteran. It's more an additional choice, I think.
Thank you.
Mr. President? So let me give you a hypothetical, because that's what we're dealing with right here. I mean, we heard from Klamath Falls. We basically, I think we saw a judge, a circuit court judge, saw a PBS show, and they got a court and started down the road. And I mean, I can do the math quick. You know, 68 times the cost of bed times 12 months comes up to real money real fast. And in your case, it sounds like maybe the district attorney and one of the commissioners.
Advisory.
Came up with this, you know, about 18 months ago. So if we as a group were trying to tell someone, I don't know, ODVA or somebody said, look, you need to put together this set of information and provide it to whom to try and get more either dockets or drug courts going, what would your advice be? What would we do? How would we go about doing that? You're the legislator for the day. Job sharing.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, first of all, it goes far beyond the district attorney and the commissioners. We had Department of Community Justice, absolutely critical partners. They actually had a vet savvy and veteran himself, PO, who sat on our working group to make sure that we were listening and making the right decisions. We had our chief criminal judge, Julie Franz, who was extremely invested. We had Chair McKeel and Chair Shiprack and their offices, either themselves personally, usually themselves, but also their offices attending. We had the defense bar. I'd say get everybody at the table, the treatment providers, and of course we had the VA, because the Veterans Administration is a critical part of the team. The way our docket works is the veteran does not have to come. It's not a specialty court, as you've already heard. So if there is a probation violation hearing, does the veteran come back before the judge, one of the two judges on the veteran's docket. And the Veterans Administration will staff that probation violation hearing, as well as the probation officer and the DA. So we'll have real-time information from the VA about that individual's treatment needs and successes and or failures. And so if there needs to be some fine-tuning of the treatment plan, you can do it right in that probation violation hearing. And I think also, with your permission, I'd just like to make the point that even though this isn't a specialty court, the veteran may still participate in a specialty court. It would not be the veteran's docket, but the veteran has the ability to sign the release of information, start the whole process, have a settlement conference, which is also part of our procedure. And then it may be a better fit for the veteran to go into one of our drug treatment courts or a mental health treatment court. We have a mental health treatment court that's, we think, excellent. The veteran can then opt into that using that package of VA services as a mitigation, so that when the DA negotiates and says, okay, we're going to go with mental health court, we can do it with a greater degree of certainty because of your VA services that are available. And you won't be on the veteran's docket, but you'll still be a veteran who has this package of services. So we're still accessing them, the veteran's still accessing them, and we think everybody comes out ahead.
Well, I wish you the best of luck, because I'm just looking at, let's see, Klamath Falls, 60,000 people, 68, you're at 4, and you got a million people. This thing could get pretty big in your county, and the more we can figure out how to get other counties or encourage you, because we have been big again on the fact that there are these federal benefits and there's other veterans benefits out there that we're not reaching out to. And even in your case, I mean, I hate to be the calloused senior officer here, but the problem is we don't have money to go out and do this all the way across the state, and so we have to go find a way to do it. And the way to do that is to tap into those other benefits that those people might have. And as you just pointed out, the cost of a bed over at DOC right now is atrocious. And just getting them there and back and forth is atrocious. I'm sure your caseload is atrocious yourself. And that's what we're looking for, trying to figure out what is, you know, do we somehow get ODVA to make a list of, you know, if you want to do a docket or you want to do a court, these are the people you should contact, or this is how you should do it to encourage them to go out and do it. Because, I mean, less than a mile away across the river, I'm in a county that's, frankly, its public safety has fallen apart at the seams because it's broke. And so, and you know, this is just another avenue that helps veterans and actually helps the same veterans that might be offending help their community back. So I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we have Jesse Barton, Eric Belt, and Lori Skillman. This is carbon paper thing, isn't it?
Yes.
That what it is? That's
Sorry,
why I can't read it.
The original statement.
Okay, got it. Jess, since they're separate, I'll let you go first as long as you're not long-winded.
I'll try not to be.
Lawyers,
Mr. Chairman.
You know.
Yeah, it's hard for me not to. But anyway, my name is Jesse Barton. I'm a practicing attorney, criminal defense attorney in this state. I've been practicing criminal defense for the last, in the state, nearly 25 years. I'm a member of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And I was contacted earlier today by the OCDLA lobbyist, Gail Meyer, about the possibility of attending this hearing. I have to make clear that Ms. Meyer has not had a chance to have her legislative committee review this bill, so I cannot speak on behalf of OCDLA. But I think I can speak on behalf of criminal defense lawyers generally. And we have some concerns with the Veteran Treatment Court system as it currently exists in the state. But before I get to that, I want to give you a little bit of background. Based on data from the Census Bureau and that a committee staffer named Brian Thies obtained a couple years ago from the Department of Corrections, Oregon's veteran population at state prison system nearly doubled from 2004 to 2012. It increased by 89%. Presently, or as of 2012, veterans in the prison system are, there's an overrepresentation factor of 125%. In other words, there are 125% more veterans in the prison system than there are relative to the statewide population. Veteran treatment courts are designed to try to arrest that problem from occurring, but yet it does occur. The concerns that my colleagues and I have with the veteran treatment court system as it presently exists is there's actually two concerns, and they're somewhat interrelated. If you think about a veteran who maybe would be the type of veteran who would go through the veteran treatment court process, he quite likely suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder and or traumatic brain injury, so PTSD and or TBI. If that's the case, he probably has defenses to the charges that should result in his acquittal of the charges. But in order to get into the veteran treatment court, he must plead guilty, which means that he has to waive his defenses, which could be perfectly sound legal defenses to the charges. That should not be a requirement. In 2010, the legislature passed Senate Bill 999, which expanded district attorney authority to divert veteran defendant cases from criminal prosecution. For the most part, that bill does not require guilty pleas. Diversion could go on. Person could try to go through the diversion program, and if successful, then the charges will be dismissed. If unsuccessful, the defendant still would have the option to go into trial and asserting his defenses. That's the way that we see it as the system should work. But the veteran treatment court system as it exists now operates on a presumption of guilt concept. We know that's the case because you have to plead guilty to get into the treatment court. That's the first problem. The second problem is one that a colleague of mine, a forensic psychologist named Robert Stanulis, has identified. This might not occur. This might not be a problem all veteran treatment courts, but is that typically, again, these treatment courts are dealing with people who have mental health or physical health issues. Traumatic brain injury is a physical health issue. And there may not be medical professionals involved in the treatment program who can address those underlying causes of the problems that the veteran has. Suppose a veteran has an alcohol problem. Dr. Stanulis will say that, in his opinion, alcoholism is a symptom of PTSD. So in order to treat alcoholism, if that's what the veteran's problem is, you have to treat the PTSD. That may not occur because in a veteran treatment court because there may not be the type of medical professionals staffing that court that are necessary. And I would say, though, from what Mr. Tilson said, it does sound like that's not a problem at the Klamath County Court. He talked about clinical work that gets done in the process. And whether that goes on in all veteran treatment courts in the state, I don't know. But it's our understanding it does not go on in some of them. So I'm not going to name it. There's somewhere it just doesn't go on. So we have this problem with and there are these sort of interrelated problems between the lack of medical staff or medical personnel being involved in the treatment court process and then the presumption of guilt problem. One solution to the problem, it would be very difficult to establish veteran treatment courts throughout the state, however they're established, but Senate Bill 999 puts in place a mechanism that works on a statewide basis. It's not been implemented. Most county district attorney's offices refuse to use it. It's been used very little in its nearly five-year existence. It's been probably, you could count on two hands the number of times it's been used. But that system is there. It could be used. Its implementation could be broadened. fund and basically take the place of veteran treatment courts without having to have actual veteran treatment courts. You just use the diversion process that Senate Bill 999 already establishes. A lot of the burden is on the defense bar. The defense attorneys need to step up and use Senate Bill 999. That's one thing that we've determined is one reason. You can say that some district attorney's offices don't use Senate Bill 99. Well, one reason is they're not asked to. Criminal defense attorneys, a study was done of the OCDLA membership two summers ago, and fewer than half of OCDLA members were even aware of the existence of Senate Bill 999. That needs to change. If that were changed and a system were put in place to try to broaden the use of Senate Bill 999, it would get the state to the point where it would like to be in if every one of the 36 counties had a veteran treatment court. That is the end of my remarks. The committee has questions. I'd be happy to answer any.
Madam Vice Chair?
Yes. So, but you're focusing on veterans treatment courts. What about the idea that what Multnomah County is doing with dockets? I mean, it's hard for me to know the difference, but to me it would be nice to have a plan from every county, just a plan on how they're going to deal with veterans. I mean, I would love to see that. Whether we implement a mandate or not is right to be seen. But can you respond a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moniz Anderson, I worked a little bit at the early stages on the establishment of the Veteran Treatment Court in this county, Marion County. And when it was first started, it was started as a Veteran Treatment Docket. Now, I never really understood the difference between a docket and a treatment court itself. But as I understand, I think the docket concept was just sort of like a first step toward actually having a full-blown court, so it would be less expensive.
Okay.
The demands, the cost of the sort of things that Mr. Tilson was talking about wouldn't be necessary. I do recall now Presiding Judge Rhodes had declared that we can start this docket, but it has to be done within its existence has to be dependent on existing resources. They weren't going to apportion more money to establish a veterans court, so they went with the docket portion, and that's just a kind of a step in the direction of having the court.
Since you indulge my time a lot, I would ask that maybe you touch base with Mr. Sparks back there. I think because I think what appears they're doing, correct me if I'm wrong, Madam Vice Chair, in Multnomah County is they have a three-step phase where the first one is you go into what we would call, what we think is the committee, a traditional court, where you're going to plead and you're going to so on. And then I'm looking for a nod back. The second one is they could just go through, they could plead not guilty and start down the process, and then if they were found guilty or whatever it is, at that point, then they can actually step back into the veterans treatment program with the county as part of, I guess, sentencing. You're the expert on this. So, the docket is starting to intrigue me more because it has the opportunities of making you guys happy and everybody else going down there. But I know Mr. Sparks is in the back, and he may be able to have something like that because I'm with the vice chair and saying, you know, but we need to see what the plans are out there because at some point when counties start defaulting outside of this committee and we have to bail them out, we need to know that we did everything we could before we got there. And so I would ask you to maybe spend some time with the DA back there. I mean, I know that's hard for you defense lawyers and DAs to get in the same room, right?
We've worked together on cases, Mr. Chairman, although we are on opposite sides.
Right. So I would ask that because I'm with the vice chair and thinking we need to do something more to educate our legal system on this thing. Okay, so you're the last two, and you're not the feds, so you don't have a purse of money. So go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Belt with the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. I would first like to start out and just talk about the need for this. I know we've touched around the edges on the nuts and bolts of how a veterans treatment court is implemented, but you know, as Americans, we must keep in mind that we have an enduring debt to all of our country's military veterans. And while news accounts remind us daily of the dangers of being deployed and involved in combat throughout the world, and the serious challenges that face our veterans as a result of that have been described today with the PTSD, TBI, substance abuse that results from conditions that are related to their service. And many of these issues can be connected to the trauma of that combat and require appropriate measures to address them. Veterans Treatment Courts were designed to do exactly that. Like has been mentioned before, treatment, not incarceration. Don't penalize that veteran for conditions that are, in fact, related to their service. Here in the state of Oregon, we've mentioned four of the jurisdictions that have stood up a combination of either a veterans docket and or a treatment court with Klamath County and Multnomah County, but also Lane County has a docket, Marion County mentioned with a treatment court, and Malheur County has stood up a treatment court that they have yet to enroll any veterans into that meet the criteria for that. So that'll be the fifth within the state of Oregon. And on that treatment team, you do have that county veteran service officer. That's the key component at the local level to meeting the needs of a veteran to maximize those VA benefits that are available to them. And two, the key member of that treatment team, for it to truly be a treatment team, is a veteran justice outreach coordinator. It's a licensed clinical social worker through the federal VA, and they work as a member of that team in order to ensure that any court-ordered treatment is available to them through the VA. And then that county veteran service officer works to ensure that, number one, they can enroll in VA and then maximize any other federal benefit that may be available to them, whether it's disability compensation, pension, education benefits, employment assistance, anything that will enable them and give them a step up to being a productive citizen and keep them out of from being a justice-involved veteran being incarcerated in the state system. With that in mind, it's from what I've seen at the local level, it's always a judge and/or a member of the district attorney's office that has the passion for leading the effort for establishing that. Because as you've heard, it does take an in-kind contribution for them to carve out time for members of that team, for the judge, the DA, the criminal defense attorney, the probation officer, the mentor leadership team, that CVSO, that justice-involved coordinator through the federal VA. So it's a fairly large team, but I think because it's focused on the veteran, the preferred method for that for a veterans treatment court would have from the judge, the bailiff, the court administrator, the mentors surrounding that veteran with other veterans. And I think when you place a veteran back into that military culture, and if you've ever been to Judge Day's treatment court, it's wonderful to see. The folks are very motivated to complete the program. That's why you see such a low recidivism rate. The defendants stand at ease and listen to the instructions given by Judge Day, and it is very much of a team environment dedicated to the success of the veteran completing the program and continuing to be a productive member of the community.
Could you talk about that there are only two of these people in
the that Veteran Justice Outreach Coordinator that is that link with the federal VA healthcare system? There are only two of them in the state of Oregon. So one of the advantages of a veterans docket as a step towards a full veterans treatment court is that it maximizes the efficiency of those Veteran Justice Outreach Coordinators by bringing in a docket all veteran defendants together so that they can meet one-on-one in a more productive manner with that outreach coordinator, with that social worker. And it also helps with the county veteran service officers as well to be able to connect them with benefits.
Where do the Federalists have these two at?
They're located in Portland, but and also in the Roseburg Medical Center.
There's one each?
One each. And then Malheur County, since they predominantly receive most of the veterans receive their care there out of the Boise VA Medical Center, they take advantage of the Justice Outreach Coordinator there out of Idaho for their court.
Am I sure? Mm-hmm. Questions?
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laurie Skillman. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And I just wanted to kind of speak. I know that the bill is a placeholder for this concept. The bill, as written, requires the department to take on the task of preparing a report and doing the research and so on. I just might suggest that perhaps the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs isn't the best agency to manage that, because this is really an issue, and it's administered by the courts. It's administered in a local fashion. We do have knowledge and information sort of generally about treatment courts, but we have no involvement in any way, except that the county veteran service officers are people that we work with and train, and it's the county veteran service officer that is the link between the veteran and the community and so on. But we just don't really have the expertise for that, and there might be some other agency that has a better expertise. We absolutely like to participate in this, provide the veteran's lens to this issue, and do anything we can for the committee and for this issue. But for us to kind of be the agency that does the research and prepares the report, perhaps there's some better place for that. Thank you.
Well, just the rationale of that, when I submitted this to LC, I said, I don't know what I want.
Sure.
All I want is veterans courts or dockets or treatment courts to be well known in the state of Oregon, and for counties to implement them if possible. Just give me a bill, and that's what I got.
Right.
And with that forewarning, I mean, there's plenty of officers back there. Just because it's stupid doesn't mean we're not going to do it either. So
yeah, that's true. That's true.
The bottom line here is, I think where we're going, I mean, where the committee, the chair, and the vice chair are going, is we're trying to figure out what to do. And I'm not sure. I mean, one of the things that's new, because the reason we're having it today is we said docket. Bring those people from Winona County. We'll give them a visa to come to this part of the state, okay? Is like, okay, they're doing something that is really not run by the judges. This is something that's a little bit different. It's not driven by the judges so much because they don't report to the judges. We're just trying to figure out, you know, how best to address this issue, because I think, as you just pointed out, I mean, you at least have the expertise to tell us that of the 36 counties, only five of them have one of these. So you're ahead of us at this point. And so there'll be a lot more on this issue to come down, because it's not going to go away. I mean, just the success rate at Klamath Falls, if it was replicated across the states, we would have less of a discussion in the public safety arena than we're having now, if we can harness those resources. I mean, and I don't know the answer, how do we get more federal, more of these individuals? Because the key component to success to some of these appears to be, you know, the federal VA, which, you know, we have a love-hate relationship, especially me being a veteran, okay, with these people. And so we don't know where we're going. But I would encourage anybody that has an idea to reach out to either Senator Monitor Sanderson or I, or reach out to council. I mean, because we have to do something different than what we're doing now. We do know that. And, you know, now's the time to do it this session, and so that's kind of the direction we're going. Vice Chair, you have?
No, I just would like to have the counties come forward with ideas, because I hate to mandate anything, knowing how strapped everyone is, but I still think this is an important issue, and it would be nice to get feedback from counties that don't have anything as to maybe why. But again, it seems to take DAs with a sort of a passion for this, or an advisory committee, yeah, or county commissioners.
Right, I'm looking at my county alone, and I'm looking at the cost here. You know, the 68 number out of K Falls is $6,800 a day in savings for one of my counties. $6,800 a day. Now, if we go to state and DOC, we all know the numbers there. They're significantly higher, and the 160 was used. And so, Jess, I mean, again, we're looking for some solutions here, and I'm almost thinking Multnomah County may have found a sweet spot in there that might be something that we can do, and then I think we're more than willing to try and force our federal colleagues to try and help leverage, because the benefits are out there and they're required by law to provide them. So it's their problem if we need them. With that, any other comments? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 157, and we're going to go back to the public hearing on Senate Bill 408. We're going to go right down the list. I see crossouts. I believe I'm going to ask Jonathan Sanford and Scott Thompson to come up. And Madam Vice Chair, you have a comment?
Senator Boquist, I'm honored, extremely honored to be part of this extraordinary effort to preserve the history of the thousands of Oregon veterans who have served Oregon and our nation. And the men and women who made Oregon's military history really do deserve a special place for future generations to come and learn about their sacrifices and triumphs. I had the opportunity to visit, and the number of artifacts that are there, they'd open drawers for me, and I would see medals, and I'd see uniforms, and I'd see hats, and I'd see, I mean, you can't believe all of the artifacts they have, let alone the idea of having an interactive system or displays for our young people to learn. They're going to have learning experiences that I think will honor the service commitment and the history. There'll be hands-on family activities. And I'm just really excited about the idea of actually having a place, a military museum that everyone in Oregon can go and enjoy and learn.
So before we get started, we had a video that was created to explain the whole process of what we're going to do, and we're ready to get started.
Well, good luck in this state with ID problems.
There's just so many things here, thousands, that are truly irreplaceable.
There is no other place in Oregon that truly tells Oregon's military history. This is the repository. Stories are here.
The Oregon Military Museum began in 1975. We are now the official state repository for Oregon's military history. And the collection is absolutely a treasure trove of Oregon history.
Everyone in Oregon has some kind of military connection somehow. I'm sure all of you have a chance to know somebody that's been involved in the military and to remember what they did and what other Oregonians did for Oregon's military history. It's a way to remember that.
There are 14,000 artifacts that document the history of Oregon from the early militia all the way through today's troops. The collection has just some really outstanding objects, World War I aviation, Korean War memorabilia and militaria items that really document Oregon's participation in all of the major conflicts, as well as at-home missions and training missions. We are very proud of the fact that the collection is recognized nationally and sometimes internationally. The weapons collection is especially large. It's one of the largest west of the Mississippi River, if not the largest, of military arms. There are 750 small arms and about 100 artillery pieces. The vehicle collection is also well known, and many of those vehicles and the weapons will be on display here at the museum when we are able to reopen. During base realignment and closure, the space where the museum buildings used to be was actually needed to create a new Armed Forces Reserve Center. We all looked around. The best building on camp with a comfort to stay here was to move into the 1954 Clackamas Armory. This building had not been renovated, had no air conditioning, so we had some challenges. Just the moving here alone took 14 people 6 months. We palletized all of the artifacts, the 750 cubic feet of archives, and 30,000 library books. We are slowly unpacking. That is one of our major emphasis right now. But as renovations are going on, it's very difficult to live in the building that you are renovating as well. So we do some leapfrogging of assets and collections and pallets in order to clear an area so that people can go in and work as the funding becomes available.
The Historical Outreach Foundation has a $6.5 million capital campaign. So we're definitely made some progress on that. Every penny, every dollar, every $20 helps. If every Oregonian donates $1, how many Oregonians do we have? If every person who has a connection to Oregon's military history donates $20, we've made our $6.5 million capital campaign. We need everybody's donation to be able to help make this a reality.
A lot of it just has to do with available funding, both from the capital campaign and from the National Guard in their support for the museum. The first stage will be before we're going to get all the behind the scenes area remodeled, get better storage, space saving storage, get those artifacts protected back in the vaults where they belong, where they can continue to keep working, get stuff put away.
One of the other things that are going on right now is the exterior. Renovations are going to include demolishing or removing existing old buildings and relocating one of them and actually making it a historic building to the point where it will look like the old original quartermaster storehouse that is underneath all of the renovations that had been done to it. And that's all going to begin this summer.
We want to be able to have the money available so that as soon as we have it, as soon as we can start moving forward, that we can move forward. We need to be able to set up a new parking lot out there, set up the tracks and treads. We want people to be able to see the tanks and the big guns that we have out there.
The exhibit hall will be totally revamped. We're going to be adding about another 5,000 square feet to this facility. We'll be putting in a big entryway and a lobby, and also a gallery area that will help circulate people throughout the museum.
About half of the building will actually become display space, which is fabulous because that's four times what we used to have in terms of space that was dedicated just to public displays. The building really fits the needs. It has great bones. We just need a little more renovation in order to complete the needs and make it a really outstanding regional attraction.
It's going to be a beautiful location. People can come, they can have picnics here, they can have events here, they can learn history. But our ownership, I'll be able to say my grandfather, who died in World War II, his history is saved here. I am in the Oregon Army National Guard, and my history is here. My time that I spent in Desert Storm is saved here, so that my kids and my grandkids will be able to come in and be able to learn about what I did, about what my grandfather did, about what our neighbor did.
We're excited that we're in this new home. It's a golden opportunity for us to really expand our ability to serve Oregonians, and I think we'll be a major regional attraction here in the county as well as the state. And we're looking forward to reopening our doors soon. That's it for now. There's more to come.
Are you up, General?
I guess so. I'm Brigadier General Raymond C. Byrne, Jr., retired, former Adjutant General, and the Board President for the Historical Outreach Foundation. I am in support of Senate Bill 408. That was a very good introduction as to where we're going as far as the museum concerned. There's a couple things that I'd like you to keep in mind as you think about support for the museum. First, there is no museum that commemorates the rich Oregon military history. This is not a National Guard museum, but all services will be represented at this museum. It's more than a warehouse for things. It represents the represented artifacts. They tell stories. They tell stories of people and events. It will also provide a place for a one-stop place for people to donate artifacts for their families and friends. There is no place in the state of Oregon where that occurs now. And from this museum, we will be able to loan artifacts throughout the state and nation. General Hokanson, the current Adjutant General, supports this, and I am going to read a letter from the former Adjutant General, Major General Reese. Senator Brian Boquist, I am in writing in support of SB 408, funding the Brigadier General James B. Thayer Oregon Museum. The museum will provide a space to educate the public on our rich history of Oregon military past, from the time of our tribes, our first military history, through the future's exhibits showcased Oregon defense industry. The museum will include stories of Oregon's 41st Infantry Division and artifacts from World War II, Oregon Korean and Vietnam involvement, and current deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. This last group is especially important as Oregon's 41st Brigade currently has over 1,000 soldiers deployed to Afghanistan. They will return soon in June of 2015. The Oregon Military Museum has been in existence under Oregon statute since 1975. Adequate funding has been elusive. Through self-help initiatives and impressive philanthropic efforts, the museum now has the seed money to reach its full potential. Support from Oregon legislature is needed to bring this to fruition. Please lend your support to SB 408. Let us ensure that the sacrifices of our past and present generations of Oregon service men and women are not forgotten. Very respectfully, Raymond F. Reese, Adjutant General, Oregon, retired.
Okay. General
Scott.
Come on, Scott. You can sit next to the general. He doesn't bite. What he doesn't know is we might need this equipment if the Federalists keep up what they're doing anyway. And for the record, we're going to continue on as a information meeting.
Good afternoon. My name is Scott Thompson, and I am a volunteer board member of the Historical Outreach Foundation. I'm also a small. I also own a small construction company, and am an adjunct instructor in the School of Business at Portland State University. Thank you for your support and creation of SB 408. General Byrne talked about telling stories. I'd like to tell a couple brief stories. A couple years ago, my wife and I, and my wife Tanya's here with my two kids, Jack and Jane. My wife and I took our kids to northern France to commemorate the D-Day landings in Normandy. We wanted our kids to experience the history while there were still veterans around to share it. We thought there would be a big event at the American Cemetery, which there was, which we participated in, but what we didn't realize is that each of the tiny little French towns in northern France celebrated their own Liberation Day from Nazi Germany. So we'd wake up in the morning, we'd look at the map, and we'd say, where are we going today? Where are the events? We'd go to these events where these small towns, we've never seen anything like it. The small towns would close down all the businesses. Everybody in the small towns would flood the streets, and they'd treat these elderly veterans as rock stars. It's probably the closest thing that we saw. Since we spoke English, many of the veterans kind of gravitated towards us, so we got to meet a few of them, and we accomplished what we set out to do in talking to them. One of them said to me, as we were in this giant throng of French people, he said to me, he said, you know, we don't get treated like this back home. And he didn't mean it. It wasn't a negative comment. It was just a fact that, you know, that they don't get that treatment. The museum will be both a place for us to learn of the sacrifice of the men and women of the armed services and also a place for us to show our appreciation. Part of the foundation's mission is to help veterans and their families share their history. At a Veterans Day event this last November, my son and I met Mrs. Appleman of Lake Oswego. Her late husband, Ralph, was an engineer in the Navy. He helped build the harbors at the coast of Normandy during the D-Day invasion. She invited us to her house to look at old photographs and memorabilia. With each visit, there was a renewed interest on the part of her family in the service of their loved one, and her adult children and grandchildren would join us in these meetings. And as they searched through old photos and artifacts, it was like someone had turned on a light in this family, and they glowed as they shared the stories of a hero who had contributed so much to ensure our freedom. The Brigadier General James B. Thayer Oregon Military Museum will be a gathering place built with the purpose of preserving our history and strengthening bonds, and it will help bridge the gap between our citizens and the veterans to whom we owe so much. thank you for supporting it, and thank you for continuing to support it through the process.
Senator Broquist and Senator Juana Sanderson, thank you so very much for this opportunity. I'll be very brief. I'm John Sanford, like Sanford and Sons. I do the legislative efforts for the Historical Outreach Foundation. I'm also a disabled combat vet. I served in Iraq in 2006 as part of the 3670th out of Oregon, and later in the 364 Civil Affairs to try to help the different groups we were working with. I've since worked for Congress, lately leaving U.S. Senator Ron Wyden's office as his Veterans of Defense advocate for the last 4 years. I'm here to support Senate Bill 408, obviously. It's no wonder that almost every state senator and almost everyone on the Veterans House Committee has supported this military museum. It's time. It's a nonpartisan, common sense proposal, and I want to make sure I thank you, Chair, very much, especially for your support, and Madam Vice Chair. I would also be amiss not to mention that the good Attorney General, Brigadier General Hokanson, has stated his support for the museum. This is huge. This is very important, especially for this bill, as long as we can find new money for it and that we do not negatively affect their cycle of money. One simple ask, though, is this is going to go to Ways and Means. We have to make sure it doesn't become gut and stuffed, which is hijacked. That's a possibility of it. We all know that. But considering how many people have signed on to it and the ability to tell the stories of people that have been in the military or people that are very interested, whether it was a nurse in Vietnam or her experience or people in the Special Forces, however we tell the story, we want to make sure it does not get hijacked when it goes through Ways and Means. So that's my one ask, and I just want to say thank you very much for this opportunity. It's now my honor to introduce Alicia Hamill, the Executive Director for the Historical Outreach Foundation and the one that's really put together all these efforts.
Like you said, I'm Alicia Hamill. I'm from the Historical Outreach Foundation. I am the executive director there. Thank you, Chair Boquist, and thank you, Senator Juana Sanderson, my senator. Appreciate it. Thanks so much for your consideration and sponsoring of Senate Bill 408. We do want to make sure that we don't take any funding away from the military department from their current budget. We want this to be new money. Oregon has only one comprehensive Oregon Military Museum. It is located in Clackamas at the first official training site of the Oregon National Guard, Camp Withicum. The Oregon National Guard and Army Reserve has recently consolidated multiple units into one training site at Camp Withicum, having thousands of military drill there every month. The Oregon Military Museum will tell their stories and the stories of all of Oregon's military from the time of the tribes through our future, showcasing Oregon's defense industry and what they are building to make our military safer, more efficient, and stronger. The Oregon Military Museum has the largest weapons collection west of the Mississippi River and the largest Japanese artillery collection in the world. These collections and stories that will be told at the museum will delight and entertain not only Oregonians, but visitors from around the world. The Oregon Military Museum will also educate our students to show pride in Oregon's role in American history. We can't tell Oregon's history without telling Oregon's military history. We can't tell Oregon's military history without telling Oregon's history. These stories truly tell Oregon's history from our beginnings until now and into the future. I am a Desert Storm veteran. I am proud that my story will be told at the museum. My stepfather, when I returned from Desert Storm, told me, "Thank you." Because of Desert Storm, he was now getting some respect for what he did in Vietnam. I always say thank you to him. Because of what happened to him in Vietnam, I was treated like a hero when I returned. Let's all remember the sacrifices our veterans make and remember their stories. There is no better way to honor our veterans and those who support them than to remember them. As my stepfather again says, he's pretty wise, everyone dies twice. The first time is when your body dies. The second time is when the last person who remembers you dies. Let's not let any of our military stories die. With amazing support from the Thayer family and the band KISS, momentum for the Oregon Military Museum has been growing exponentially. Thousands of Oregonians have donated to support, and there has been widespread positive press coverage, even internationally. Oregon's private donations to the Oregon Military Museum come close to $2 million. Federal dollars have been raised for architectural design and construction. Clackamas County financially supports the Oregon Museum. The state of Oregon needs to also financially support it telling its own military history. I just want to reiterate that we do not want to compete with the Oregon Military Department for old funds. Any new funds for the Oregon Military Museum would be greatly appreciated. Please pass this bill through your committee and ensure that it makes its way through Ways and Means to the governor's desk. Oregon needs to remember its military history. Thank you. Any questions?
Yeah, hijacking is always a problem. Scott, how did you get involved in this?
I mean, I
get the general and I get everybody else here. You feel like odd man out here or what?
Well, my father was an officer in the Army, and I have uncles who served in Vietnam, Korea, World War II. I did not serve. And so when my kids were young, it really started with Veterans Day and Memorial Day. I didn't want that to be another day off of school for them, so I started looking for events. I got involved with the Portland Veterans Day Parade, and through them I was introduced to Alicia and the group she's doing. And really, it's just out of a sense of duty. I feel this is what the best way that I can serve for not having served myself.
I mean, that's a big undertaking for a young family to go to Europe, and I mean, it's just a huge undertaking.
And something my kids will never forget.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In another lifetime that General Byrne knows about, I mean, I was walking across the plains of Russia looking for territory that we were interested in using, and the locals found out that we were there, kind of hard, you know, kind of white Caucasian American-speaking person in the middle of Russia. It's not exactly one of those things you can hide very well. And it was amazing. This was during the first Gulf War. I must have had 50 people that were the age of my father come out to thank us for giving them M1 Garand rifles in World War II to fight the Germans. And you talk about it right there where you know you went to France. They were in the middle of nowhere. They didn't speak any English. And these are villages that are what we'd call third world villages, for the best word, in south of Russia, and it's exactly the same thing. And people I never met, they were just thanking, you know, and we always, especially today, we see the 6 o'clock news and, you know, the Russians are doing this or the Ukrainians are doing that or so on and so forth. But when you're over there and somebody that age is saying thank you for, you know, helping us, you know, that long ago, it's amazing. So heritage we need to preserve. I have no clue how Senator Ramona Sanders and I are going to negotiate this one, but that's what we get paid the big dollars, $1.57 a day or something for, right, General Byrne?
Yeah, if I may, one point that that wasn't raised in the testimony was this will also be the home of the Veterans Legacy Program, which will be an oral and visual history. So it'll provide an opportunity also to document stories other than artifacts, the stories of these people. So. Also, that's important as far as the museum is concerned.
Madam Vice Chair?
I want to talk about budget because I think there's not a member on this committee that's going to vote no on this, and we will be sending it to Ways and Means, which then you will have to testify again and make your case, and that will probably happen in who knows when. But I know that you had wanted a dollar amount put in, a $3 million amount, and I had made, said, let's leave it open. But I think it would behoove you in your next presentation to talk about a $3 million amount and what that $3 million amount will buy, what you will actually be using that for, and then also make sure that you state that that the guts of the museum is being paid by Fed money?
Federal loans, yeah.
The
federal
loans. The construction and the architectural design were paid by federal.
Yes.
The inside, the exhibits have to be raised privately and through state dollars.
Right, and I think that is important to convey too, because we're especially if the kicker kicks, we're going to be in. We will have to struggle, but
Sure. It's only day two. Let's not get into doom and
gloom. All right.
I'm the chair. I'm supposed to talk about doom and gloom. You're supposed to be the warm and fuzzy.
Yeah, right. That's right. So anyway, I'm so glad that you came to testify, and you have really made it an exciting project for us. And I'm so glad that so many people have signed on to it. So that's good.
Yes.
Thank you. Anything else, folks? Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Mr. Clem, Mr. Stuckey, I think you're the last two. Dan, I promised the Mr. Stuckey he'd be last, so that means you have to go first.
Go ahead. Thank you, Chair Boquist and members of this Senate committee. My name is Dan Clem, and I am testifying in support of Senate Bill 408 and its referral to the Ways and Means process. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. Oregon is doing a wonderful job in catching up with its veterans. In 2000, I had the honor of escorting General Thayer back to Austria, where he had helped liberate a concentration camp. A 19-year-old kid from Oregon in charge of thousands of people trying to figure out how to feed them. The Burgermeister found out that we were there and declared a town holiday, shut down the schools for 3 days, and we drank a little bit of beer.
Did you get a donation?
No, but the beer was great. We've, in talking with the Burgermeister in German and Northern Austria, Mauthausen concentration camp was nearby. They noted that at almost every road junction in every city, there were, as Scott had explained earlier, celebrations and commemorative sites. He asked about the commemorative sites in the U.S. and indicated that we were just starting a memorial for World War II and for the other wars, and to honor our veterans, and we do that quite frequently. We're catching up with our veterans with veterans' homes, with veterans' drug treatment courts, with an understanding of how to better connect them with the benefits they so well deserve. But in Oregon, there is no home for the memories of the service of all. We do a good job with memorials. We did the a field of flags in Riverfront Park to honor all those who've served. But in fact, there is no permanent place. Oregon Military Museum, the James B. Thayer Museum, will help us to do that. We have honor flights going back to Washington, D.C. This museum will give us a way to honor them here. It'll be a tough battle in Ways and Means. I hope that we can provide more information that will help justify the expense. Everybody is involved in this. We just are hoping that the state will be involved in honoring its veterans. With that, I can answer questions after Mr. Stuckey.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, Dave Stuckey, sorry, apologize up front. I'm having a cold here, and I'm not projecting my voice very well. I'm the Deputy Director for the Oregon Military Department, representing Adjutant General Major General Dan Hokanson here today. And we know Military Department and General Hokanson certainly does support the museum. This is a worthy cause. Preserving our history, educating our state is very, very important. Installations branch and the federal government has certainly donated its share to the museum. We need more. We have about six projects going on up at the museum now in ongoing status. It's actually really just starting in the and we have a contractor, Precision Construction, that's actually developing this. Six contracts total, about $3.6 million in federal dollars, but it certainly is just the infrastructure, not the components that actually make this museum a real museum with the displays that it has. It's been stated a couple of times, I just would like to repeat this from the military department standpoint, that in regards to this bill, you know, we believe this is a worthy cause, very, very important. We have a number of issues that are also very important within the military department. We would ask that if the legislature so elects and wants to produce some or fund this project, that it's new money and that it doesn't distract from the military department budget. But with that, I'll answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're almost there. Does anybody else want to speak? Forever hold your peace. Yes. I skipped introductions only because all four members are seasoned members and we've been here before. And as you can see, we're already, 18 minutes late? 18 minutes late. But I haven't seen anybody come in there and start going like this yet, so I'm fairly safe. I think on SB 408, I mean, we'll be hearing more about this in the future as the vice chair and I figure out, you know, what we're going to do next and how we're going to do it. Likewise, I don't think SB 157 is going away. Once again, the chair and I have to kind of figure out how we're going to thread the needle and go forward on this. So contrary to popular belief out there, I mean, this is going to have to be and will be a bipartisan effort. So with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on 408, and we will reconvene next week, same time, same place, and we'll slow down a little bit and do introductions then.
Would you...
Just a second, I got a question.
Would you...
Just a second, I got a question.